Blog Talk Radio.
It's the V-Spot. I'm your host, Dr. Vic Tater. My co-host is Bill Foster. V-Spot Radio is brought to you by Planet Vic Tater Blog Network. Get everything you need and a few things you truly do not want. Only at Planet Vic Tater. Morning episode. Neil, how are you doing?
I couldn't sleep last night.
Me neither. I was tired by 6 a.m., so I went to sleep, and it took me, and I woke up at 11. And then
I was kind of up by 8 because I went to bed around 4-ish, and I was kind of like, okay, need to try to get up. If I tried to dwaddle too much in bed, dozing in, or getting 5 more minutes, I'll miss it. Like, okay, how many minutes has it been? 2 minutes! I may sleep a little bit more. Okay,
yeah.
hope it didn't oversleep. How many more minutes has it been? 5!
That's pretty much what would happen with me when I was trying to. And there was a helicopter or something outside. It sounded like it was right above my apartment. So I don't know what the hell was going on there. We're supposed to be having Bill Oakley on right now. He hasn't showed yet, but hopefully he will. If we know our time zones, then we most assuredly don't.
Well, I do. It's more the fact of whether or not he knows.
Jeez, Bill!
Was he one of the Harvard writers?
Yes. He was the one that had
that makes it doubly funnier.
He was the one that had his Harvard nameplate thrown at him by Krusty.
Harvard. Yes, sir. That's the worst kind of a yell, man.
Get ready for the episode. We watched the episodes that he had written, the episodes he'd written, like Margin Chain, which was a crazy episode. And, you know, it was funny how these were just a bunch of little vignettes tied together, but it was hilarious.
And yet that's not one of his craziest ones.
And he also did the casino episode, which is like one of the greatest 30-minute episodes in the history of anything. Like, I would say it's one of the greatest 30 minutes of anything in the history of the world. It's got all the glitz of the British Isles and all the glamour. Now, I promise when he calls in, we're not going to just quote episodes he's written.
Well, we're going to try not to.
So I know people that write shows just love it when people do that.
Oh, wait,
here he is. Let me let him in.
I can try
Bill Oakley.
Hello.
All right, you just missed a very entertaining round of us quoting stuff you wrote over 20 years ago.
Oh, fantastic. I suppose you don't want to do it again.
We were just talking about the casino episode, and for some reason the thing that struck me was the British guy that was trying to start a British casino with very ugly women.
Yes, right.
Okay, well, I guess to start, how did you get the job writing for The Simpsons?
Well, Josh and I, this is back when I was working with Josh Weinstein, I'm sure you know, we were unemployed for a long time after college, and I think finally what happened was we wrote a spec script for Seinfeld, and for people who don't know what a spec script is, it's basically you write an episode of your favorite show or whatever, and then, you know, you get people to send it around, and we wrote this Seinfeld episode, which got a lot of things going for us, and it got us a couple different job offers. And one of them was an offer from Mike Reiss and Al Jean to write an episode of The Simpsons, and that one became Marge Gets a Job, which was a story that Conan came up with. And then it turns out they they liked our script a lot, and just at that same time, they had an opening because Jay Kogan and Wally Waladarsky were leaving, so they offered us a job, and everything worked out for the best.
When you're writing a when you were writing with Josh Weinstein, how exactly would that process work? Would y'all come up with jokes together? But who would it like do the actual writing, like actually having to put it into a script?
You know, our process evolved over the years. Let me tell you what the process is now that I use and Josh and I use on projects we work together, and then I will tell you the process which we used back then. Right now, basically what happens is you just kind of you do a rough draft, and then you polish it up, and then you do a better draft, and you fix things that aren't working, and that's basically the normal process. The process we used at The Simpsons was, in retrospect, I suppose it worked out for the best, but it was the most torturous possible process. It was the opposite of that. It was basically that we would start from page one, and we would just, we wouldn't, every single thing had to be perfect. And we would write from page one to page 60 and in order and do it together, basically just sit in front of the computer together and not move along until every single line was perfect. In retrospect, I think that probably was a waste of time, and because we were always writing 20 more pages worth of stuff than we really ultimately needed to write because we didn't have a rough draft to begin with. So that was the process. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody. I would use that second process, which is writing a rough draft first and then coming back and writing what you really need to put in this show as opposed to a lot of extra stuff that isn't needed.
Actually, I find it weird that you would say that it would be that rough and rigid of a structure, since it seemed when we would go back and see some of the old Simpsons, it would seem like you would have like a base outline for a plot and then you would just kind of cram as many jokes as you can that fit in with the plot.
We would do that, except that we had way too much. We always had way too much. Every episode, I think, you know, not just our episodes, but every episode from the time we were there was probably at least 150% too long. And so there'd be way more material written than needed to be written. Maybe that, you know, and ultimately maybe that worked out well because there'd be so much to choose from, except that, as I'm sure you know, sometimes people had to cut out stuff. We always ended up having to cut out stuff that was funny because otherwise the plot wouldn't make any sense. Sometimes, you ended up cutting out stuff, the plot, and then the plot didn't make any sense because you had to make a choice between the jokes and the plot. And at some point, you know, things are going to suffer if you have to cut one of those things too deeply.
Let me ask one thing. And this is like skipping way ahead, but I have to know this now and I'm going to forget if I don't. Why did they cut out the Richard Simmons robot? And
I'm going to tell you about that. Everybody loves the Richard Simmons robot, but at the time, many of us considered it to be super hacky. And by hacky, I mean something that everybody was doing at that point in time. Right now, looking back, whatever, 15 years, you know, it's like, hey, Richard Simmons joke, that's hilarious. But at the time, and I'm seeing like, what, 1993 here, every hacky comedian was doing Richard Simmons jokes. And it was on everything, you know. Jay Leno was doing it, and I don't even know if he was on the air regularly at that point. But like, let's just say that the air was oversaturated with Richard Simmons jokes, and it was the feeling of most of the writers, but not all of them, that The Simpsons shouldn't be doing that. That it was that we should come up with, I don't know, ultimately what was in there, was the dogs with beads or something. It wasn't like
he locked
whatever
the door.
Whatever ultimately was put in there was not, I don't think was probably better than the Richard Simmons robot, but it was not Richard Simmons. And I think, I have to say that, you know, people at The Simpsons are and were comedy snobs, and I think we felt that that was a little beneath us to do Richard Simmons. But ultimately, I think putting it on the air years later, it's pretty funny.
I remember you would say, like, on the commentaries, you would spend, so long just making the actual plot, then you'd spend like probably like 12 to 14 hours just writing little jokes that you would flash for like a second, like on billboards. So, like, you
yes.
have like,
oh
you
my
know,
god, we spent so much time doing that stuff. It really did, yes. And I hope that, I mean, it seems like people are still enjoying it all these years later because we really did devote a lot of time to stuff that I think only maybe less than 1% of the audience even noticed.
Well, you know, it's one of those things, Joe, you know, in hindsight, with DVD, since the advent of DVD, it's one of those things that's paid off, I guess.
Good, good.
Okay, let me, when you were writing Marge Gets a Job, the one thing that stands out for me in this episode is, number one, is I think this is the first time Smithers did something very, very evil. What, kidnapped Tom Jones?
Yeah, okay, you know, see, this is an example of what happens, and I think that I love that episode. It is what happens when, in the course of many episodes, is that you start out with something that plotted a story that's pretty realistic, right? And then, and this happened with a number of episodes, especially Marge episodes, because Marge isn't really a fountain of comedy, you know? Like, she doesn't have that many failings and shortcomings like Homer and Bart do. And so what happens is in Marge episodes, often you have to start throwing in, or we had to start throwing in crazy stuff to overcome the shortcomings of Marge as a comedy character. So each draft, it got crazier and crazier and crazier. The draft, initial draft, was pretty believable. And then as time went on, it got more and more nuts. That also happened with the other Marge episode that we wrote that year, which was that Marge goes to jail, which was I think it was pretty believable in the first draft. And, I mean, it's much funnier, but it's totally insane. That whole, all that crazy crap with Jimmy Carter, History's Greatest Monster, which we all love now. At the time, I think Josh and I were like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it was supposed to be a little bit more like a second or third season episode that was pretty believable, and instead it ended up being like one of the craziest episodes of that whole year. But, you know, I think that paid off ultimately. Those decisions, which I would not have made at that time, I now made them.
Well, considering about four seasons later, you would actually have a Bond villain as a nice guy to just show off and just play it off as nothing.
Right. Well, that was, you know, that's what happened. That's what happened between seasons. I don't have to tell you guys. Between season 3 and season 8 of the show, a lot of the boundaries that initially had been there dissolved over time. And there were certain milestones where that happened, like Homer going into space. And I remember this was so controversial at the time. We were like, Homer's supposed to be a regular guy, and the show was supposed to be about the travails of this guy's regular suburban guy's family life, you know, and his job and whatever. And here you have a story where this guy is going to be launched into space. He's going to be the most famous guy in America. And believe me, it tore the staff apart at the time. Ultimately, because so much work was done on the episode, I think it came out really well. But and then after that, there were a number, I mean, probably beginning with the monorail episode, things just, and then progressing all the way up to what you're talking about, things got looser and looser as time went on. And again, that's probably good because it was keeping the show fresh. I mean, how many episodes could you do about, like, you know, Bart getting an F or Homer getting a new job? And there's probably been, at this point, there's probably been several hundred of them, but at the time we were trying to mix things up.
Just because I don't want to forget this, the Jimmy Carter thing, when I was a kid, I thought that was hilarious because I thought it was such a disproportionate response to a former president. When I got older and I saw how people respond to Jimmy Carter, it became even funnier.
Now that you point that out, I think it's true. Because it was like, he was such a mild-mannered guy who was building houses for poor people, and Habitat for Humanity, and that just because I guess his presidency wasn't really that successful, this vast overreaction. But now people really, yes, because of the Republican propaganda machine, I guess you would call it, people really do seriously think of Jimmy Carter as a monster, which is just crazy. But
this guy one time told me, he said, with Jimmy Carter, I paid more for a gallon of milk than I ever have. And this other guy was like, yeah, you pay more now than you did then. What's your point?
Right.
The Margin Chains episode, whose ideal was that? Like the general concept.
I don't remember. It was definitely assigned to us there because that was our first job on staff. It might have been an idea that had been around for a while. And it was assigned to, you know, that's what happens when you're the low guys on the totem pole. You have to do the Marge episodes. And that's what happened with us that year.
How would that work as far as the show went? Now, with guys, so you wouldn't be pitching your own ideals, or would it be just at the beginning of the year, guys would just put ideals in a pot?
Well, what happens is, at least back then, we had these things called story retreats, and everybody, twice a year, like a lot of the way that things, let me just take a step back here, a lot of the way that stuff was done on The Simpsons in the 90s was taken from the way that things were done under Jim Brooks at Mary Tyler Moore and Taxi in the 70s and 80s. And they had these things called story retreats where the guy, everybody, all the writers would come up with stories. And in those days, you know, in the days of Taxi and Mary Tyler Moore, they would be like, these guys would go to Palm Springs, they would go to Hawaii, and they would like play golf and have fun and do all this crazy crap and then work on the stories. By the time that The Simpsons rolled around and we were working there, we would go to a hotel, a conference room in a hotel that was a block from the office. And it would be one day and we wouldn't even get to spend the night or anything, you know. So it was like a big meeting, basically. Anyway, all the writers would bring their stories. We'd have them twice a year, and people would bring their stories, and everybody would try to really get the best stuff they had worked out for these retreats, because everybody would be there. You know, Jim Brooks would be there, and Matt Groening would be there, and sometimes Sam Simon would be there, all the writers and all the assistants who take notes, and you'd have to be the focus of attention for a good 10 minutes as you told the story, so you'd want them to be great. And that was the process. Now, where we come up with this stuff, I mean, from all over the place. I mean, from our own lives, from articles in the news. Josh and I got a lot of different ideas from USA Today, frankly, back in those days. The gambling episode and Malibu Stacy both came from articles in USA Today.
What was the first episode that you got the pitch that actually got made?
It was the gambling episode you just were talking about.
That's good, before we move to talk about Mission Hill, just so we can have some time. Well, we know it's kind of based on the indie comics, but which I can't remember which ones you said specifically influenced the design.
It was a combination between the work of Dan Klaus, who did this comic called 8-Ball, and Peter Bagg, who did this comic called Hate back then, which was also known as the Buddy Bradley story or whatever.
Okay.
It was inspired by those things. And
yeah,
a lot of different
influence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. Both Josh and I love that material, and we kind of try to use our Simpsons skills to bring a world like the world depicted in those comics, you know, into the primetime TV world. And it did not, as you know, probably it didn't succeed. It was a miserable failure in the primetime TV world, but it had a second life on Adult Swim where it probably was a better fit.
Me and Neil were discussing this last night. Does penis guy have a name?
Like, what's his name in the script? It doesn't?
I would have to look it up. You know what? He doesn't have a name. He's not like Just Stamp the Ticket Guy in The Simpsons, who goes by the phrase, you just call Just Stamp the Ticket Guy. I think it's just like it's just businessman or something. There's no good name for him. Sorry, the answer
is
like, so unsatisfying.
Kind of like the guy who goes, yes.
Yes, exactly.
In one episode, he was called, Homer referred to him as that jerk that always says yes.
Yeah, that's Frank. I think it's called Frank Nelson. You know, that's the character that is from that. You guys know that that's not The Simpsons is not invented that guy. He's from Island.
Yeah, he's based on some old. Yeah, he's based on I saw him on an episode of Sanford and Son.
Yeah,
an old
he was
director. I can't remember
character
his name.
Director. I think his name was Frank Nelson, and he was definitely around since the '50s. And he did that yes kind of thing in a lot of, and I love Lucy, but probably a lot of shows for the '50s. 50s and 60s, and The Simpsons just kind of resuscitated him and whole hog and took his thing and started using it.
With Mission Hill, one question with Mission Hill, with like Kevin and Andy, are these kind of semi-personal accounts of your Josh Weinstein?
Yes, they're all the characters, I can't tell you who, but they're all people that we know. Everyone in Mission Hill is either someone that we knew or someone that we met or a combination of people like that. But many of them are still our friends, so I can't talk about where they came from.
You know, when I was watching the first few episodes, I couldn't help but thinking that Andy was a very good brother.
Yeah, in retrospect, he actually was pretty good. He was grumpy, but I think, you know, he did have a certain sense of responsibility, which I think ultimately kind of funny to see him being dragged along into being kind of a responsible adult father figure for Kevin, who was so annoying.
I was telling Neil that with most people, I think the pilot would last 5 minutes when Andy would tell his mom to piss off.
Right, right.
Going back to Simpsons, because, again, you've got done so much stuff, you know, it's a lot of ground. How did you get the job? How did you and Josh Weinstein get the job of being showrunner?
You know, it was a combination of fortuitous events, one of which was that Conan, who was the next person in line to be the showrunner, suddenly became a famous talk show host and left the show. Because at that point, Josh and I, after being there for only about a year and a half, became the most senior people because many of the people from the first few years, like Mike Reitz and Al Jean and John Vitti and Jeff Martin, all suddenly left. And very quickly, Conan was the most senior person, and we were the second most senior people. And then Conan, miraculously, in 1993, Conan became the host of Late Night and instantly left. And then after David Merkin left, it seemed like we probably just had the most experience and knowledge of the show. And I think that he put us up for the job. So that's the process as I know it. I'm sure there was other stuff behind the scenes that I wasn't privy to, but that's basically the story I think I pieced together.
Okay, when you got the job, did you ever have any attitude? Were there any things that you wanted to change about the way the show was ran, like it could be a minor or something that you didn't think they were doing before, or were you just trying not to mess things up too bad?
All of the above, I'd say. We had a plan of what we wanted to do, the kind of shows we liked, which was we wanted to make it just like season three all over again. We always thought season three. I still think season three is the best. And we, by the way, I should say we weren't even there on season three. We were just watching the show as fans. I still think that season three is like the best season of television ever made by anything ever anywhere. And so our goal was really to just make another season three. And literally, we sort of mapped out. I've told this story before, but we looked at season three and we're like, what's the composition of episodes? How many Bart episodes were there? How many episodes were there, you know, that were emotional versus how many that were just crazy? And also we figured, well, every season's got to have at least one Sideshow Bob. Every season's got to have one Itchy and Scratchy. So that combined with the fact that we wanted more realistic episodes. The majority of the family wants to be pretty realistic, which is why we started out with that Home Sweet Home Diddly Dumb Doodly one written by Vitti that was a real throwback to the early days of the show. So that was what we did. We basically just wanted to copy what we thought had been great about the show in its early years. And, you know, but keeping in mind that a lot of boundaries had already been pushed during seasons 4, 5, and 6, so we had more to play with. You know, we weren't so confined to it being domestic comedy. We had crazier stuff in there.
Okay.
I guess that's why
now,
you did more crazy stuff like the Simpsons spinoff showcase and the 138th episode spectacular. Just trying
to
break any norms.
We did want to have at least. I think we've reserved at least two episodes per year for just going batshit crazy, which was like we felt like, you know, given that we were making 22 or even 24 episodes a year, we felt that it was, given all the realistic, emotional, grounded ones we were doing, we felt that we also wanted to do two that push the boundaries that were just crazy and broke down the walls. And I think one of the first ones we did was 22 short films.
Yes.
And the other two you mentioned that were just like, they bent the format, they bent the genre and what expectations you had from a sitcom. We thought, why not, what better place to play with them? Also because, and I'm sure you guys have heard this before, that we didn't ever get any notes from the network. And you know, I don't know how many shows in the history of television have been in that position, but it can't be more than like 10 over the past 50 years of television where the show was so blessed through various circumstances that we didn't have executives meddling the show. I mean, nobody, we didn't answer to anybody at all. So we could do whatever we wanted and they had to broadcast it. And it was a rare treat to be able to do that.
You know, the spinoff Showcase, that has probably my favorite line in the history of the show that did not belong to a regular character, and it's when Big Daddy's getting ready to run, and he goes, "Oh, Lord, have mercy, I wish I weren't so fast."
Yeah, that is funny.
And I say that to this day, any time I have to do something that requires me to move fast. In the episode Sideshow Bob Roberts, now, this is one of mine and Neil's favorite bits ever, when Homer suddenly gets thrown out of a car by the Archie gang and Moose goes, "Duh, stay out of Riverdale."
Yes. I hadn't thought of that in a long time, but that is, I like that. That's crazy.
How did that bit come up? Because it was this funny thing, because you get the feeling that Homer had been involved in something that we weren't privy to. Like, it was like,
yeah.
It was almost like it was a B-plot that wasn't being shown.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's supposed to imply, that he'd somehow been screwing. Well, first of all, we were big fans of Archie. Both Josh and I were big fans of Archie. And a number of things that I think people think The Simpsons made up actually came from Archie. Like, I'm pretty sure that Yoink came from Archie. And I'm pretty sure that Eep also came from Archie. You know, Eep, which people do. Lionel Hutz did it in that Marge jail one. I'm frankly sure that both. I'm 80% sure that both Yoink and Eep came from Archie. And God bless Archie for not suing us for using them. Anyway, what you're saying, that was just basically a quick joke that we came up with to end whatever scene that was. But we loved, as you said, that it implied that Homer. That Springfield had there. Obviously, there was another fictional city somewhere nearby besides Springfield. It was Riverdale, where the Archie gang lived, and Homer had somehow been causing trouble there. But we didn't get to see any more about it.
And later, I love this bit later when he's in the car, he's reading an Archie comic, Seething.
Yes. Yes.
Now, when you were showrunner. What was your favorite episode come along during that time that you were running the show?
I don't know. See, the thing is that, like, I have to say that over time, my opinion of various episodes have changed, and they have changed historically, too. Like, nobody really liked 22 short films at the time. And nobody really liked the whole Frank Grimes thing at the time, too. And now I can't stop seeing everybody saying how it's a favorite episode, and Ricky Gervais as saying it's the best episode of television ever. And I'm like, well, Mr. Gervais, you should give me a call then. But, you know, nobody at that time, nobody liked that either. And I think that a number of things were about many of those episodes were shocking and off-putting to viewers back then. But over time, as people's senses of humor have changed and people have had a chance to see the episode in a different light, I think they've come to enjoy them. Anyway, at the time, I think, you know, I still really like a lot of the more standard ones, like the 300-pound Homer one, the king-size Homer. But I really did have affection for 22 short films. But at the time, I was kind of – at the time, I didn't keep talking about it because it seemed like nobody liked it. So I just shut up about it. But there were other ones. I think we all felt at the time that the Bond villain one, you only moved twice. And that was Greg Daniels' story, which is a super solid story. And the script by Swartzwelder, you know, just added all these great details. But I think that may be one of the ones that at the time we all, the one that we all liked at the time that has also been liked over the years. You only moved twice. That's the name of it.
I like to on the East Coast. I know that some people don't seem to like those type. Some people don't seem to like those endings, but some do. Like, some didn't like the prisoner ending. But some of those are actually just kind of hilarious. Just kind of end that way.
Right,
the
which
thing
one,
I liked
which
about this was an ending. This was after you left. The computer wore minute shoes. There was this, Homer captured and put on an island because he had made up these lies, and it turned out one of them was true.
Right. Okay. I only vaguely remember that.
Okay. The thing with the ending of You Only Moved Twice, when Homer had the Denver Broncos, the thing I found funny about that, he's very sad, but 2 years later in real life, the Broncos won 2 Super Bowls in a row.
Dude, I was just thinking about this recently, and I regret that it was the Denver Broncos. Here's the thing: it was supposed to be the Houston Oilers. This is in the original draft of the script. In the original draft of the script, and even at the all the way up to like the animatic of the, it was Houston Oilers, which was perfect because the Houston Oilers were always in the basement. Nobody cared about the Houston Oilers, but they were moving the next year to become whatever, Tennessee Titans. And
yeah.
Is that what happened to them? And so we just were like, we can't have it be Houston Oilers. Nobody's going to remember who they are. It doesn't make any sense. And nobody's going to, like, 10 years from now, people are going to think that's a made-up team. So it became Denver Broncos, and we didn't. Nobody was really satisfied with that. One, because I know George Meyer, who was there, who's also, first of all, a huge Broncos fan, but also, you know, he liked to get things right. And I think we had, like, even John Elway was receiving in that. When you see with the Broncos on the lawn, the numbers are all wrong, and John Elway is being receiver rather than the quarterback, and there's a lot of screwed up stuff about that. And in retrospect, I wish we had picked a team that was a worse team that would be still around. Anyway, I it's the first time I've said that, but I wish we had fixed that and not had it in the Broncos.
Well, that just works so much better than Houston Oilers, you know, just because they're in Texas, and you never hear people in Texas, even back then, talk about the Oilers.
Right, right. Well, as at the time, the rationale was, this team is going to be gone next year, so we better change it. The same thing happened with, you know, by the way, at the end of the George Bush episode, that was supposed to be Nixon, you know, not Ford who moved next, all the way up till, again, the animatic or whatever, it was Nixon who moved in next door and was really friendly to Homer. But Nixon died during the course of that episode, and we were, like, debating who it should be. For a while, for a few days, it was Bob Dole. And then we decided that we figured out, like, oh, wait, Ford looks just like Homer if you draw it like this, and then we made it Ford.
Now, was it still going to be Ghost and Menace jokes on that episode, though?
What?
Was it still going to be, like, Ghost and Menace, though? Or not part of the writing staff?
Wait, sorry, I didn't hear that part.
The George Bush episode when Bart was harassing him, was it always intended to be like a Dennis the Menace parody?
Yes, it was supposed to be just that. That's exactly right.
Okay, how did that idea come about to have Homer get into a fist fight with George Bush?
That was an idea that Josh and I had that we had been saving up for a while. We had it during, it was one of the ideas we were messing around with during the, someone, David Merkin was running the show, but we never did it for whatever reason. And then when we took over, we assigned it to Ken Keeler wrote that, right? We assigned it to Ken Keeler, and it was just basically we felt like George Bush was we didn't want to do a political – this is another episode that was pretty much hated at the time, certainly by a number of people on the staff, including Harry Shearer, who gave us no end of crap about it, it was not political in any way. We were like, George Bush – the real-life George Bush is an old – seems like an old grouch. And having someone like that be Homer's neighbor – it actually kind of – that and Frank Grimes were two similar ideas. It might have been the same idea at one point that split into two episodes because it was like, how about an old grouchy guy who takes everything seriously? That seems like somebody who would be seriously annoyed by Homer. And then I think the idea was, let's make it George Bush because – I don't know how that came about, but that became that episode, and the Homer's Enemy became Frank Grimes' episode, and they definitely have similar underpinnings.
One thing I noticed is a lot of the episodes that happened when you and Josh Weinstein were showrunners, that has been mined a lot in later years. Like Frank Grimes, like they'll still do things where Homer's still harassing Frank Grimes in the grave, like he took his tombstone.
Yeah, that one, we needed a super dark – the thing about that one is, and it's very clear, that episode – let me say this, and I think I said this before in the past. Homer, we had to turn up Homer's bad behavior in that episode because if he was just acting kind of normal, it wouldn't be that funny. And so Homer's behavior is consciously dialed up to be worse than usual, or at least usual at that time, throughout the whole episode. And at the end, we were like, he's going to have to do something horrifically bad taste to really make it clear what this episode is about. And then we're like, oh, well, that's a funeral. He can be – because – and I don't have to repeat – let me just say this, state the obvious. The whole point is the show takes place in Homer's universe. And in Homer's universe, Homer wins at the end of the episode no matter what. You know, that's the way that The Simpsons works. You know, you don't usually have an episode where Homer doesn't win or things don't get reset at the end. And so Frank Grimes was the unfortunate victim of that. The detective universe was against him.
I think when I was, I remember when we were watching this on DVD, Neil was disturbed by how much I was laughing as Frank Grimes was being lowered into his grave.
Yeah, it's dark. It is dark, man. People, as I said, back then, people did not like that. It was, we got one letter. The thing is, this was back when people sent letters to TV shows, which seems so antiquated now. But, like, all we got was one letter from some guy, who I think some guy who worked on, like, an army base or something in somewhere in California who just said, you guys nailed it, you know. That's the frustrating, that we nailed what it was really like to work with a bunch of dopes. And this guy, obviously, I think felt that the people he worked with were idiots and were wrecking everything. And this guy, he really summed up what we had. We knew that it got through to this one guy. And so we put that letter up on the wall and we enjoyed it. And later we heard other people liked it, but that was years later.
Yeah, growing up, you know, because like for me and Neil, you know, The Simpsons, you know, I can think of the number of Simpsons episodes I hate. Like, you know, and I can't say on one hand, and usually if I watch the episode again, I laugh at it. But so when I got on the internet, the biggest surprise for me was, like, there's people that hate The Simpsons?
Yeah, man, I'm telling you, look back at those things at SNPP and the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant, and you'll see people, this is what I learned from reading that and over the years, is that you can never, and I think this really goes back to that whole, like, you can please all the people some of the time or some of the people all the time or whatever, like, I've never seen a Simpsons episode that more than 80% of the audience liked. And there's always at least maybe 10 to 20%, even in the best case scenario, that hate it with a violent passion. I've tried to figure out why that happens. And I think people's senses of humor are a very personal thing. And I've seen it happen with Josh, you know, like, and with Josh and me, where like we watch an episode of some other show and one of us loves it and one of us hated it. And it's just because we later realized that it was because someone was in a bad mood, you know, that night or whatever, and just like didn't want to be amused or didn't, you know, there was something in it that struck them wrong. And it is a personal thing. But anyway, if you look back at those comments from season 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 that people were posting on the internet at that time, it seemed like the end of the world was coming. People were so outraged. At least 30% of the audience thought that every episode was the worst episode ever, and you know, that's where that phrase came from, was alt TV Simpsons.
We had contested episodes
like that, like even on Mission Hill, we've been contested because I didn't want to watch the Lamborghini episode again,
uh-huh.
Just because I've seen it so many times. It just just something about the episode just kind of rubs me wrong, like the fact he has to spin a bike. How much was it for that windshield wiper? It was like a whole lot just to pay for that or the gas.
Yeah, it was a couple $100.
Well, you know, we've almost got into fist fights over some things. Like, we get into fist fight, like, we almost got into a fist fight over season 8 because I said Brother from Another Series is a better episode than You Only Move Twice. And I love You Only Move Twice. I just think the episode with Sideshow Bob's brother is better.
I don't agree with you, but I'm happy that you have that opinion. I feel
I know I'm in the minority.
But he also likes
Trash
Titans better than You Only Move Twice.
It's a good episode. It's a good episode,
yeah,
but you know, it doesn't. And it's also because I'm just I felt that like You Only Move Twice had, mainly because of the work that Greg did, had a plot that worked. Every single thing came off like clockwork in the plot, whereas In Brother from Another Series, I think the plot, and Ken, who wrote it, I'm sure would agree with this because of all the hoops we had to jump through writing it, that the plot has a lot of kind of forced parts of it. That's not to say the character isn't funny. The character of Cecil is great, but, like, You Only Move Twice. This is boring. I don't need to go into this. You know, I just think it's more, I think You Only Move Twice is a more elegantly constructed episode.
Question, just for we have time. Whose idea was it to have Ronald McDonald, The Meaning of Life, in that episode where Andy has just, like, the worst day ever?
You know, I don't remember whose idea it was. I do remember that we needed something that could come off, that we weren't going to show the whole thing. Like, it had to be something that you could, in a split second, because we weren't going to reveal it, because it was supposed to be, the joke was, that for those of you who didn't see this episode, the joke was, Posey, the kind of spacey, hippie girl character, is meditating, and for the whole episode, and at the end, she's finally gotten to the point where she's going to reach the meaning of life, and she's interrupted just at that split second that it's being revealed, and we only get to see a fraction of it. And for people who freeze frame, it appears that what she's seeing is a giant statue of Ronald McDonald. So I think it was just, I don't know who came up with it, but it was a combination of us and probably the designers who were like, what could you possibly show in a split second that people might be able to figure out? You know, and you're only seeing a fraction of it, I think, as well.
Yeah, it's not very long.
Well, it's also, that's kind of a, almost could be deemed a depressing episode, because that's just like, I can't remember all the terrible things that happened to Andy in that episode. I don't think it really got shown any good resolution. It's just that,
it's just
shit on all day.
Oh,
we
no,
only got
the end. No, no, at the end, it's got that happy ending, remember, where
yeah.
Michelle Butterfield gives him a kiss and invites him to come to the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony or something.
Well,
yeah,
no, Kevin gets it, but he missed it.
right, okay, I do remember that.
Okay, you know, going back to Brother from Another Series, you know, that is the only ending of a Simpsons episode that bothers me to this day.
Yeah, what is, refresh my memory about the episode. Oh, Bob Saves the Children. Right, well, this is Terminator. You realize that the whole thing is, it's Terminator 2, right? It's the story of, the whole plot is basically Terminator 2, where the previous villain, there's a new villain worse than the previous villain, who has to now become the defender. It is like, not to give away too much of the secret of writing, but like that is basically the whole idea was, let's do Terminator 2 with Sideshow Bob and his brother being the T-1000.
It's just like, to this day, though, also there's this thing, and I do this with my own nephews when they're being bad. I'll take them to their mother, and I'll say, your children are no more.
Right.
And I'll hold them by the scruff of their necks.
Yeah, it's been a bunch of, what is it, been a bunch of misbehaved hooligans or something? What is it? Take a part of that sentence?
Okay, let me ask you about Cleveland Show, well, because we've only got a few more minutes, and I really love both the episodes of Cleveland Show you wrote. The first episode had a great line in it, where he's like, oh, Don, I'm sure I'll be just as sad at your funeral, and my third wife will be mad at me.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I have to say that the Cleveland Show, when I work on the Cleveland Show, it is, you know, they are a very collaborative process, and it's more like, a lot of the lines are come up within the room, and a lot of the dialogue comes out of, like, Mike Henry's mouth as he kind of semi-improvises it. So I don't, you know, I don't have a good memory for who came up with what line. I think in many cases the lines that you're going to probably love are lines that were kind of semi-improvised by people who were recording it at that time.
In the second episode you wrote, American Prankster, was it your ideal to give Principal Farquhar so much more to do?
No, I think that was something they put in later. I don't even have a real good knowledge of the Principal Farquhar character, so that was not my idea.
Because they never really do anything with him in any other episode, but in this one he was very, I can't describe it, but he was very, he had a very big personality and would just do these very long, winding monologues, and he never did this in any other episode.
I do not. That was not my idea. I don't have any idea where it came from.
What are you working on right now?
Right now I'm working on several different projects. I'm the co-executive producer of the show Portlandia, which is IFC, has stars Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein, and our third season is just about to start in about 2 weeks. And then I'm also working on a few other pilots. One I'm working on with Josh, and I'm also working on one with Rachel, who is my wife, who also wrote a few Simpsons episodes back in the day. And we're developing a new animated show together. So those are the three things that I'm most busy with right now.
Well, we've still got time. Who is your favorite minor Simpsons character?
Oh, Superintendent Chalmers. I'm sure I've said this before.
I mean, Superintendent Chalmers.
And I'll tell you why. It's like, he's the only sane person in this whole city. You know, like, It always, my favorite show growing up was Green Acres. And I mean, I was born long after Green Acres was on the air, but I saw it in reruns. And one time we did a poll in the Simpsons writer's room, and it was totally coincidence. Like, out of the 12 writers, including Matt Groening, 10 of them